Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Listen to my voice, isn't it all deep and thingy? My band played a gig tonight. There was a lot of talking involved, a lot of loud noises, and now my voice is like this. This is all the voice I've got to play with. So if you're just tuning in for the first time, my voice usually isn't this sexy. But hey, use it while you've got it. It's really late. I'm really tired. I didn't do this right. I've got to start doing my podcast earlier. I've seen that we've got about, 20 or so, or 30 or something, new subscribers overnight. I don't know how that you guys came along, why you came along, but I'm glad you did. So welcome to the fray. Today we're talking about words. The Enormous Room, Chapter 4, Part 2? Wait, what are we talking about today? Yeah, Part 2 of Chapter 4. And then we're going to be reading Part 1 of Chapter 5. I can't talk properly because my brain has logged off for the night. What did you think of the narrative in this chapter? Cummings spent 5 or 6 pages describing, I think, 4 or 5 characters back to back. Who did he describe, and do we need to take note of those characters? I was information overloaded immediately, so I can't remember any of them. And did you have a favorite line in this chapter? Those are the questions I asked you guys, just basically using you all as a reference to help me get through the book at this point, rather than trying to prompt an actual conversation. But hey, whatever. I figured if I missed something, you probably did too. Swim said the mummifish. He said, reading this chapter brought to mind Papillon, 1973 movie with Dustin Hoffman and Steve McQueen. It was set in a French prison. Terrific movie based on a true story. The Enormous Room would make a good movie, I believe. Techrific said, now I'm curious, who would you cast in it? All right, I'm going to ask that question in today's discussion prompts. Also, surely someone's made a movie of this. Enormous Room, spelt the American way. Film. I'm just Googling film. No. Doesn't really look like there's a film. It looks like there's some kind of student short films or something. Alright, cool. Let's make one. I Am a Norwegian said favorite line was just because it reminded me of Abominations of Yondo, a short horror story by Clark Ashton Smith. He's like H.P. Lovecraft, if Lovecraft could write. They were each other's biggest fans. The cheeks had known sons of which I might not think. The feet had travelled nakedly in not easily imagined. The chapter ends with both B and Cummings exclaiming how fine of a place the prison is and how happy they are to be there instead of in the service of A. The facade has still not cracked, if it's a facade at all. I was also totally lost during the description of the characters. The description of one was instantly lost as he immediately proceeded to describe some other man. The pace is bound to pick up now, though. This was day 1 of 90 or so. I hope the pace picks up. The pace was really good for the first 3 chapters, and then chapter 4 just seemed to fall in a bit of a heap for me. There was too much describing of the place. The whole setting was described in that chapter, and all the characters, and it's just a bit too much exposition, I think. I think writers can seem to do that. They do the information dump, and they dump everything on you so you know the setting and you know the characters. But it's not actually really necessary. People will keep reading to learn about those characters and to learn about that place. He kind of didn't set that up very well, I don't think. Techrific said, yeah, I was lost. I lost my way among the characters too. It could be a deliberate trick to emulate the confusion he's feeling, a little bit like how the narrative went a bit wonky when he was drunk. Oh, that's a good point. Maybe that's it. Like, he's overwhelmed with meeting all these people, and that's the feeling he wants the reader to get. In that case, then, cool. Mission accomplished. Also, I'm geographically confused, too. They were in Normandy, going to Paris and then southward towards Marseille, but the detainment camp is in La Ferté-Macé, and that is still in Normandy. What gives? What did I miss? I am Norwegian, said, I thought Cummins misinterpreted Marseille or something like that as Marseille. I'm not sure if Cummins is in the book, has any actual idea of where he is. Okay. We misunderstood where he was going. Also makes sense. All right, now we're going to read the first half of the next chapter. And it's going to be really awesome. This chapter's called A Group of Portraits. And I'm going to read up until page 23, actually. With the reader's permission, I beg at this point of my narrative to indulge in one or two extrinsic observations. In the preceding pages, I have described my pilgrim's progress from the Slough of Despond, commonly known as Section Sanitaire Ving et Un, then located in Germain, through the mysteries of the Noyon, Grey, and Paris, and to the Porta de Triage de la Ferté Maître Orne. With the end of my first day as a certified inhabitant of the latter institution, a definite progression is brought to a close. Beginning with my second day at La Ferté, a new period opens. This period extends to the moment of my departure and includes the discovery of the Delectable Mountains, two of which, the Wanderer and I shall not say the other, have already been sighted. It is like a vast grey box in which are laid helter-skelter a great many toys, each of which is itself completely significant apart from the always unchanging temporal dimension, which merely contains it along with the rest. I make this point clear for the benefit of any of my readers who have not had the distinguished privilege of being in jail. To those who have been in jail, my meaning is at once apparent, particularly if they have had the highly enlightening experience of being in jail with a perfectly indefinite sentence. How in such a case could events occur and be remembered otherwise than as individualities distinct from time itself? Or, since one day and the next are the same to the such a prisoner, where does time come in at all? Obviously, once the prisoner is habituated to his environment, once he accepts the fact that speculation as to when he will regain his liberty cannot possibly shorten the hours of his incarceration, and may very well drive him into a state of unhappiness, not to say morbidity, events can no longer succeed each other. What happens, while it may happen in connection with some other perfectly distinct happenings, does not happen in a scale of temporal priorities. Each happening is self-sufficient, irrespective of minutes, months, and the other treasures of freedom. It is for this reason I do not propose to inflict upon the reader a diary of my alternative aliveness and non-existence at La Ferté, not because such a diary would unutterably bore him, but because the diary or time method is a technique which cannot possibly do justice to timelessness. I shall, on the contrary, lift from their grey box at random certain to me more or less astonishing toys which may or may not please the reader, but whose colours and shapes and textures are a part of the actual present, without future and past, whereof they alone are cognizant, who, so to speak, have submitted to an amputation of the world. I have already stated that La Ferté was a porte de triage, that is to say, a place where suspects of all varieties were herded by le gouvernement français, preparatorily to their being judged as to their guilt by a commission. If the commission found that they were wicked persons, or dangerous persons, or undesirable persons, or puzzling persons, or persons in some way insusceptible of analysis, they were sent to La Ferté to a regular prison called Pressing in the province of Sarthe. About Pressing, the most awful rumours were spread. It was whispered that it had a huge moat about it, with an infinity of barbed wire fences 30 feet high and lights trained on the walls all night to discourage the escape of prisoners. Once in Pressing, you were in for good and all, pour la durée de la gueule. With durée was a subject of occasional and dismal speculation, occasional for reasons, as I have mentioned, of mental health, dismal for unreasons of diet, privation, filth, and other trifles. La Ferté was then a stepping stone either to freedom or to Pressing. But the excellent and inimitable and altogether benignant French government was not satisfied with its own generosity in presenting one mere with Prasing. One merely with Prasing. Beyond that lurked a Kushmar, called by the singularly poetic name Isle de Groy. A man who went to Isle de Groy was done. As the surveillant said to us, leaning out of his little window, and to me personally upon occasion, "You are not prisoners. Oh no, no indeed, I should say not. Prisoners are not treated like this. You are lucky." I had de la chance, all right, but there was something which the pauvre M. surveillant wot altogether not of. As for my fellow prisoners, I am sorry to say that he was, it seems, to my humble personality, quite wrong. For who was eligible to La Ferté? Anyone whom the police could find in the lovely country of France, A, who was not guilty of treason, B, who could not prove that he was not guilty of treason. By treason I refer to any little annoying habits of independent thought or action with intemps de gueule are put in a hole and covered over, with the somewhat naive idea that from their cadavers violets will grow, whereof the perfume will delight all good men and true, and make such worthy citizens forget their sorrows. Fort Leavenworth, for instance, emanates, even now, a perfume which is utterly delightful to certain Americans, just how many La Ferté's France boasted, and for all I know may still boast, God himself knows. At least in that republic amnesty has been proclaimed, or so I hear, but to return to the surveillant remark, j'avais de la chance. Because I am by profession a painter and a writer, whereas my very good friends, of all of them deeply suspicious characters, most of them traitors without exception, lucky to have the use of their cervical vertebrae, etc., etc., could, with a few exceptions, write not a word and read not a word, neither could they faire la photographie, as Monsieur Auguste chucklingly called it, at which I blushed with pleasure. Worst of all, the majority of these dark criminals, who had been caught in nefarious plots against the honour of France, were totally unable to speak French. Curious thing. Often I pondered the unutterable and inextinguishable wisdom of the police, who, undeterred by facts which would have deceived less astute intelligences into thinking that these men were either too stupid or too simple to be connoisseurs of the art of betrayal, swooped upon their helpless prey with that indescribable courage which is the prerogative of policemen the world over, and bundled it into the La Ferté's of that mighty nation, upon some at least of whose public buildings it seems to me that I remember reading liberty, egality, fraternity. And I wondered that France should have a use for Monsieur Auguste, who had been arrested because he was a Russian, when his fellow munition workers struck, and whose wife wanted him in Paris because she was hungry, because their child was getting a look queer and white. Monsieur Auguste, that desperate ruffian, exactly 5 feet tall, who, when he could not keep from crying, one must think about one's wife or even one's child once or twice, I merely presume, if one loves them, et ma femme est très gentille, elle est française, et très belle, vraiment elle n'est pas comme un petit homme laid. Ma femme est grande et belle, elle sait bien lire et écrire, vraiment et notre fille veut des voir notre petit fils. I've got no idea what that means, and I'm sorry for butchering all that. Used to start up and cry out, taking B by one arm and me by the other, allons me à mes chantons, quack, quack, quack. Whereupon we would join in the following song, which Monsieur Auguste had taught us with great care, and whose renditions gave him unspeakable delight. Un canard de plume chez elle, quack, quack, quack. Il des est ce canard fidèle, quack, quack, quack. Il disait, quack, quack, quack. Il faisait, quack, quack, quack. Quan, spelling is mine, finirons nor dessines, quack, 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 quack. I suppose I will always puzzle over the ecstasies of that wonderful duck, and how Monsieur Auguste, the merest gnome of a man, would bend backwards in absolute laughter at this song's spirited conclusion upon a note so low as to wither us all. Then, too, the schoolmaster. A fragile, little old man, his trousers were terrifically too big for him when he walked in an insecure and frightened way, His trousers did the most preposterous wrinkles. If he leaned against a tree in the core with a very old and also fragile pipe in his pocket, the stem, which looked enormous in contrast to the owner, protruding therefrom his three sizes too big collar, would leap out so as to make his wizened neck appear no thicker than the white necktie which flowed upon this two sizes too big shirt. He always wore a coat which reached below his knees, his coat with which knees perhaps someone had once given him. It had huge shoulders which sprouted like wings on either side of his elbows when he sat in the enormous room quietly writing at a tiny three-legged table, a very big pen walking away with his weak bony hand. His too big cap had a little button on top which looked like the head of a nail and suggested that his old doll had once lost its poor grey head and had been repaired by means of tacking its head upon its neck, where it should be and probably belonged. Of what hideous crime was this being suspected? By some mistake he had three moustaches, two of them being eyebrows. He used to teach school in Alsace-Lorraine, and his sister is there. In speaking to you, his kind face is peacefully reduced to triangles, and his tie buttons on every morning with a bang, and off he goes, led about by his celluloid collar, gently worried about himself, delicately worried about the world. At eating time, he looks sidelong as he stuffs soup into stiff lips. There are two holes where cheeks might have been, lessons hide in his wrinkles. Bells ding in the oldness of eyes. Did he by any chance tell the children that there are such monstrous things as peace and goodwill? A corrupter of youth, no doubt. He is altogether incapable of anger, wholly timid and tintinnabulous. And he had always wanted so much to know if there were wild horses in America. Yes, probably the schoolmaster was a notorious seditionist. The all-wise French government has its ways, which, like the ways of God, are wonderful. I had almost forgot the bear, number two, not to be confused with the seeker of cigarette ends. A big, shaggy person, a farmer, talked about Mon Petit Jardin, an anarchist, wrote practically all the same to the gentle annoyance of the schoolmaster at the queer-legged table, wrote letters which he read aloud, with evident satisfaction to himself, addressing my confreres, stimulating them with even greater efforts, telling them that the time was ripe, that the world consisted of brothers, etc. I liked the bear. I had a sincerity which, if somewhat startling, uncouth, was always definitely compelling. His French itself was both uncouth and startling. I hardly think he was a dangerous bear. Had I been the French government, I should have let him go berrying, as a bear must and should, to his heart's content. Perhaps I liked him best for his great awkward way of presenting an idea. He scooped it out of its environment with a heavy paw in a way which would have delighted anyone save the government français. He had, I think, Viva la Liberté tattooed in blue and green on his big hairy chest. A fine bear, a bear whom no twitchings at his muzzle or starvation, nor yet any beating could ever teach to dance. But then I am partial to bears. Of course, none of this bear's letters ever got posted. Le Directeur was not that sort of person, nor did this bear ever expect that they would go elsewhere than into the official wastebasket at La Ferté. Which means that he wrote because he liked to, which again means that he was essentially an artist, for which reason I liked him more than a little. He lumbered off one day, I hope, to his briar patch and to his children and to his confreres and to all things excellent and livable, and highly desirable to a Bruin. The young Russian and the barber escaped while I was enjoying my little visit at Orne. The former was an immensely tall and very strong boy of 19 or under, who had come to our society by way of a solitary confinement, bread and water for months, and other reminders that to err is human, etc. Unlike Harry, whom, if anything, he exceeded in strength, he was very quiet. Everyone let him alone. I caught water in the town with him several times and found him an excellent companion. He taught me that Russian numerals up to 10 and was very kind to my struggles over 10 and 9. He picked up the cannonball one day and threw it so hard that the wall separating the men's corps from the corps de femmes shook and a piece of stone fell off, at which the cannonball was taken away from us, to the grief of its daily wielders, Harry and Fritz, by four perspiring plantons who almost died in the performance of their highly patriotic duty. His friend, the barber, had a little shelf in the enormous room, all tricked out with an astonishing array of bottles, atomizers, tonics, powders, scissors, razors, and other deadly implements. It has always been a mystery to me that our captors permitted this array of obviously dangerous weapons when we were searched almost weekly for knives. Had I not been in the habit of using B's safety razor, I would probably have become better acquainted with the barber. It was not his price, nor yet his technique, but the fear of contamination which made me avoid these instruments of hygiene. Not that I shaved to excess. On the contrary, the surveillant often, nay, bi-weekly, as soon as I began drawing curtains, Franks from Norton Hodges reasoned with me upon the subject of appearance, saying that I was come of a good family, and I had enjoyed, unlike my companions, an education, and that I should keep myself neat and clean, and be a shining example to the filthy and ignorant, adding slyly that the hospital would be an awfully nice place for me and my friend to live, and that there we could be by ourselves like gentlemen and have our meals served in the room, avoiding the salet and manager. Moreover, the food would be what we liked, delicious food, especially cooked all, quoth the surveillant with the itching palm of a grand central porter awaiting his tip, for a mere trifle or so, which, if I liked, I could pay him on the spot, whereat I scornfully smiled, being inhabited by a somewhat selfish regard for my own welfare from kicking him through the window. To the barber's credit, be it said, he never once solicited my trade, although the surveillance soi mim oneself lectures, as B and I referred to them, were the delight of a numerous friends and must, through them, have reached his alert ears. He was a good-looking, quiet man of perhaps 30, with razor-keen eyes, and that's about all I know of him, except that one day the young Russian and the barber, instead of passing from the corps directly to the building, made use of a little door in an angle between the stone wall and the kitchen, and that to such good effect that we never saw them again, nor were the ever-watchful guardians of our safety, the lion-hearted plantons, aware of what had occurred until several hours after, despite the fact that a 10-foot wall had been scaled, some lesser obstructions vanquished, and a run in the open made almost, one unpatriotically minded might be tempted to say, before their very eyes. But then who knows? May not the French government deliberately have allowed them to escape after, through its incomparable spy system, learning that the barber and his young friend were about to attempt the life of the surveillant with an atomizer brimful of TNT. Nothing could, after all, be more highly probable. As a matter of fact, a couple of extra fine razors presented by the soy-meme-minded surveillant to the wily couffier in the interest of public health, as well as a knife which belonged to the kitchen and had been lent to the barber for the purpose of peeling potatoes, he having complained that the extraordinary safety device with which on alternate days we were ordinarily furnished for that purpose, was an insult to himself and his profession, vanished into the rather thick air of Orne along with the barber, Lumim. I remember him perfectly in the enormous room, cutting apples deliberately with his knife and sharing them with the young Russian. The night of the escape, in order to keep up our morale, we were helpfully told that both refugees had been snitched ever they had got well without the limits of the town, and been remanded for the punishment consisting, among other things, in travaux forces a perpetuit verbum sapientibus, he that hath ears, etc. Also, a nightly inspection was instituted, consisting of our being counted thrice by a planton, who then divided the total by three and vanished. Alright, that's where we're going to pause for tonight. Thanks very much for listening. Have your say over on Reddit thingy, reddit.thing.com/thehemingwaylist, and I'll see you tomorrow.